Welcome to Majestic Radio. I'm interviewing Tom Vallone today from the Integrity Research Institute. He has quite a few things to say about alternative energy, future with carbonless fuels, and electrogravitics. Hi, Tom. Are you there?
Hello.
Hi.
Glad to be with you.
Glad to be with you, too. The first thing I want to ask you is about the Integrity Research Institute. Tell me a bit about the Institute and its mission.
Integrity Research Institute is dedicated to energy research and education. We were actually incorporated in 1991 and have been in the Washington, D.C. area pursuing the goal of educating the public with new future energy technologies. We've sponsored two conferences. The first one was in 1999, the Conference on Future Energy. And just last year, in the year 2000, we had a low-energy nuclear reactions energy educational workshop, which was more technically oriented toward the nuclear community. But it's kind of interesting because there's a lot of education that's needed, and people are not aware of the energy choices that are available in the near term. I can also pursue the details of future energy technologies and give you an overview of what those entail and how the public might benefit from this.
Well, what I wanted to ask you now is, what other groups are you working with to fulfill your mission at this point?
Presently, we're actually starting a collaboration with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
Right.
And it seems like their Apollo project actually interfaces with our, what we call the Manhattan Project, last year with the Senate briefing to the Committee on Environment and Public Works. Basically, the development of energy production in the United States is crawling at what will probably reach 80 quadrillion BTUs, or what they call 80 quads, by the year 2020. However, the energy demand has been escalating anywhere from 90 quads right now up to at least 130 quads by 2020. So we have a huge gap in energy that's continually expanding and diverging, which basically the Department of Energy has no idea how to address. And that is basically the bottom line when you go to any meeting, which we have done, that updates the public on energy resources and energy development. The other organization we're interfacing with is the U.S. Energy Association. IRI is a member of that organization. And just this week, actually, we participated in their latest meeting, which addressed the international energy development. And once again, I raised the question, well, this is nice to talk about helping the rest of the world, 3 billion people that don't have electricity today.
Right.
But if the United States can't provide energy for itself and has no idea how to address the energy demands its own country will continually produce in the next 20 years, how can we propose to help foreign countries?
Yeah, absolutely true. Could you give us an idea and some examples about what you call future energy?
Sure. Future energy basically entails a number of emerging energy technologies, which actually are very interesting and also posted on our website. Our website, by the way, is www.integrity-research.org.
Is there an 800 number where they can get to you, too?
Oh, sure, 800-295-7674. In fact, we offer a free catalog and newsletter for anyone that calls and leaves their address. So the important thing about future energy technologies, which I've actually presented to a number of groups, including the World Future Society and Energex 2000 and a number of other groups, is that there are a number of amazing energy breakthroughs that basically the government and private industry is now just beginning to discover and coordinate with the inventor. One of the simplest and easy to explain is the electrostatic motors invention. Now, electrostatic motors use atmospheric electricity. The invention actually goes way back to the 1700s to Ben Franklin, and electrostatic motors also is a title of a book by Dr. Oleg Jefimenko from West Virginia University. This particular invention is so simple that all it involves is putting up an antenna and a ground wire and using a particular lightweight type of motor to use up to in this case, a fractional horsepower of electricity, basically with one particular motor. They can be put together in parallel or series, and especially in the Midwest and in mountainous areas, the potential actually for the entire planet is not less than 200,000 megawatts.
That's a lot of juice.
And basically, Dr. Jefimenko points out, and he's been an expert publishing on this topic for decades, including Popular Science, telling people how to build these things, that it's an underutilized invention. And IRI, Integrity Research Institute, has been dedicated to exposing these dusty little inventions that have great potential and have been basically ignored by the public. Another good one, for example, is the beta-voltaic battery. Dr. Paul Brown patented this about 10 years ago, and it uses a benign nuclear source called tritium, which is an isotope of hydrogen, and all tritium does is produce beta particles, or in other words, emits an electron, about a 5 keV beta particle, and has a half-life of over 12 years. So you can estimate, as Dr. Brown did in his patent, that a 25-year electrical battery is very feasible, and he describes exactly how to build these, which he did and started to promote the marketing of such a product when Lucent Technologies, Bell Telephone Labs, decided to also patent basically the same thing. And so now they've had a patent re-exam that has challenged Lucent Technologies, but it shows how important such an invention is. We can also get into the suppression area of some of these inventions that basically try to supplant oil and gas technologies, but in this particular case, this probably was an issue that prevented that from coming to market at that time. There's a resurgence of interest in that, so we're still hopeful that that will come to market. And that's actually another aspect of what IRI does, is to work with the inventor, find out what he needs in terms of business plan preparation or proposal preparation, funding to develop and get to prototype stage, and then attract the investors or benefactors as necessary. I can go on with another invention that actually Paul Brown has also produced, and this is very exciting because it deals with the tons of nuclear waste that we presently are faced with throughout the country and throughout the world. Dr. Brown actually has developed a nuclear remediation project, and this one is very fascinating because it's quite simple. It uses the low-energy gamma rays, or in other words, photons, light particles, to that are actually in the X-ray region, about 10 MeV, and this improves upon any of the military or Los Alamos inventions that have proposed to irradiate spent nuclear waste. Instead, what he found was that that particular energy level, which has a technical name and description of why it works, it actually changes the isotope number of a host of dozens of nuclear waste components. In doing so, it shortens the half-life from thousands of years to literally hours or weeks.
And it renders the waste safer.
Within a short time, it can be put in shallow burial, and in the meantime is generating electricity as it's being treated.
So, Mr. Vallone, what happened to that invention?
Well, all of these are in various stages of development. The last one I mentioned, the Nuclear Remediation Project, actually can be viewed on the website called nuclearsolutions.com. And that particular one also is a publicly trading corporation that just happened recently. So that one, I feel, is the most hopeful in terms of getting to market the quickest and the soonest.
Yeah, and it would be very good to do something with the nuclear waste stream, that's for sure.
Yes. Mm-hmm. In fact, he envisions a 10-megawatt electrical generating plant as a prototype project that he will be building shortly.
So you mean you can actually get electricity out of nuclear waste?
Exactly. He's burning up the waste, which still has stored energy, and then producing something that can be buried safely.
Ah,
so it's a win-win situation, and it's like compare it to the sawdust industry.
Mm-hmm.
No one ever thought sawdust was worth anything until someone figured out you could glue it together. And all of a sudden now the waste is very useful, and we have furniture in all of our homes using sawdust.
So what are the risks of using this technology to burn up nuclear waste?
Actually, it's surprising. This particular one has almost no risk. The basic problem, as we all know is more political than physical. The political problems are in transporting the waste.
Yeah.
And therefore, he's proposing initially to build it on site, where there's already nuclear waste storage or nuclear waste generation.
So what is exactly the political problem?
Well, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has various rules and regulations about who can transport waste, how it can be transported, when it can be transported. You might have heard about some nuclear core that was going up a river out in California recently to be permanently stored in a disposal area. So there's a lot of political issues, but when it's the choice between Yucca Mountain, which basically a lot of congressmen oppose, and last year reviewed, it was sent for review, and the Congress again rejected the storage that the U.S. has spent billions of dollars on. This is certainly much more favorable.
Well, just for our listeners, the Yucca Mountain is the facility where they're going to put all this waste. They intend to bury it under the earth for 50,000 years, right?
Right, at least. Well, minimum.
Was there a shift in the NRC's position since Bush was selected, or has it pretty much remained the same?
No, that position has remained the same, and if anything else, there's even more of an emphasis on the same standard policy. But as I say, our position is that education is the best resort, and if we do continue to educate various strategic people and industry, the Nuclear Solutions Company, for example, feels very hopeful that there will be lots of investment and collaboration to make this successful.
Are there? Tell me about government acceptance of future energy and so-called discontinuous innovation. What is discontinuous innovation?
Actually, discontinuous innovation is the least understood of most innovation projects. For example, there's a textbook that's called the Fourth Generation R&D, and it speaks about managing technology and innovation and knowledge. And unfortunately, what we're faced with in general is the incremental innovation. In fact, when I was at the Joint Propulsion Conference this past summer, a few months ago, I spoke to the former director, Mark Millis, Dr. Mark Millis, of the Breakthrough Propulsion Project. Now, I mentioned the title because the public believes that there's supposed to be a breakthrough happening with NASA as they sponsor this Breakthrough Propulsion Project. But Mark Millis, as I spoke to him, explained that he's interested in just incremental changes, slow incremental changes. And as I know, since I worked at the Patent Office for 3 years, there are plenty of classified energy inventions that probably should be considered for declassification for the commercial sector so that it can be utilized to solve the energy crisis and the environmental crisis we face. And when I asked Mark Millis if he had access to classified documents, he basically said no. He's chosen not to go that route. Mm-hmm. So here's a government agent who's very responsible choosing to align itself, himself, with the standard academic routine, which is to plod along with what you know so far and keep doing the same thing, hoping something else will happen. So incremental changes are predictable. They deal with things that are very well known. But what's interesting, too, is that when you face the discontinuous changes, you also have a great opportunity that is present and not very well available with incremental changes. In fact, the great challenge in innovation is linking emerging technologies with emerging markets. And we find that with discontinuous changes, that also challenges the market. There's been plenty of quotes, even from the dean of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, to point out that if you use the rules that are applied to incremental changes, you actually will exclude discontinuous changes. And yet discontinuous innovation is precisely what you find that changes history. And plenty of us know the impacts that discontinuous changes have had.
I mean,
for example,
sudden,
the invention of the airplane.
Right, sudden technology that seems to come out of nowhere, a lot like the transistor.
Right, and the airplane. And what we find is that most people don't believe it's true even when it's presented to them. And the Wright brothers had that problem as well, and plenty of other inventors did too. When they presented something that was so different, than what people were used to. And so it's also a great opportunity that needs to be addressed, especially when you're dealing with a crisis, because the slow incremental changes will not produce drastic changes.
Yeah, many...
The contradiction that...
Typical government contradiction, and many of these technologies already exist, but they're classified.
Right, and that's the other area that we've tried to explore with government agencies and also private industry. There's another project that's worth mentioning at this point mm-hmm. in regards to that, and that is the Disclosure Project. IRI has actually been aligned with the Disclosure Project and Dr. Stephen Greer. We actually hosted him as a speaker at our conference on future energy. And his position is that the classified documents and classified inventions actually have been taken advantage of by certain industries, mostly aerospace industries,
right.
through the action of some agencies and to the exclusion of others. And so literally for decades, certain aerospace industries have developed advanced technologies, mm-hmm. which now actually are becoming known to government witnesses, and this is the part of the Disclosure Project, is to let those witnesses speak, even to a Senate hearing or a Senate investigatory meeting, and even to, as I propose, to industry, so that the technologies can be more evenly shared throughout industry.
Hmm. Many citizens feel powerless against huge corporations that pretty much govern the country's public policies. What method or tactic do you find most useful, or do you feel will be most useful to influence, say, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, or the Department of Energy, their policy? What works best? Writing letters, blocking railways?
Well, it's interesting that, for example, the Department of Energy has a cooperative research and development program that actually is available to help the government become aware and participate in the innovative process.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps this is something that at least industrial folk can take advantage of,
right.
to allow the government to use their facilities to do the research and development basically with matching funds. So this is one avenue that is available through the Department of Energy. And we've explored that, actually, on behalf of other inventors. But in general, for the individual who wants to help participate and make a difference, I would suggest, for example, the Senate bill that now is on been proposed by the Senate dealing with renewable energy. It's Senate Bill 1333,
mm-hmm.
and that particular bill offers... funding for individuals as well as groups for renewable energy. So writing a letter, for example, to the senators for the state that the listener is in actually can have a big effect and alert them to the fact that this constituent is in favor of that bill and wants the senator to vote for it.
Well, now, you just wrote this book called Energy Crisis, which is about the failure of the Department of Energy to pretty much deal with the issue. What were the main conclusions you stated in your book?
The Energy Crisis book actually was a one-year project that became sort of a labor of love for my wife and I to essentially give an overall analysis of what the Comprehensive National Energy Strategy from the previous administration was either achieving or failing to achieve. And what we found essentially was, number one, the Comprehensive National Energy Strategy did not address the expected 2010 peak of the world oil production. Literally in 10 years, now it's 9 years, the world oil production will reach a high, the maximum that is available worldwide. And by every estimate that you can find through various consultants and government agencies, the expected availability of oil is predicted to decline. Now, this is a major crisis, an impending doom, for example, countries such as the United States that may just be dependent, like 50% or so, of their energy on oil. And so anyone who sees a big tsunami coming their way would probably want to get out of the